Today's Tay Show is Case 62 in the P.N. Lu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 62 is entitled Umam's One Treasure. Ango's Introduction. With untaught wisdom, he engages in the subtle action of inaction. With unsolicited compassion, he becomes your true friend. With a single word, he kills you and saves you. In one mood, he lets you go and holds you fast. Tell me, who is it who comes this way? See the following. Main subject, Umam said to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth, within the universe, there is one treasure. It is hidden in the mountain form. You take the lantern, entering the Buddha hall, and place the lantern above the temple gate. Secho's verse, look, on the ancient bank, who is that? Holding a fishing rod, quietly moving clouds, boundless waters, the bright moon, the white flowers of the reeds, you see by yourself. I want to thank everybody for doing such a wonderful job. Again this morning, people were sitting so deeply, and yesterday afternoon as well. You know, we've been having long sits in the afternoon, and people have been sitting so still. And this is a remarkable achievement, this sesshin. You know, when we entered the pandemic in March, I wasn't sure we would even be able to practice together. And then, we started holding sits on Facebook. And with all due respect to Facebook, it wasn't quite the ideal platform. For one thing, it's not interactive. It's only in one direction. So Zoom was this wonderful opportunity when we discovered Zoom. And as some of you know, we have sitting three times a week in the evening, every Sunday morning, and half a day every Saturday, just on our regular schedule, and it's operating just like this. And then when we tried the first sesshin, I wasn't sure we would even get through the sesshin, to tell you the truth. I am still not very adept at all of this technology. And things were going wrong fairly regularly. I mentioned that I did not know the cardinal rule of Zoom. The Zoom world is that you cannot be in two meetings at the same time. So I had a meeting set up for Dokusan, and I had our regular meeting here on Zoom. And so I said, now, Keith announced Kurt will leave this meeting and he will open the meeting for Dokusan. So I went in and I opened the meeting for Dokusan and it wiped out this meeting. So it took a little while to figure. A lot of people went to Facebook, by the way. So it all worked out, you know. People had a place to go if this went down. And it all worked out. And people were practicing really diligently. It's really wonderful. And this session too, this is our second Zoom session, and we would all love to be back at Murray Grove. You know, Murray Grove is beautiful. And right now it's a little hot, but it's beautiful, and especially in the spring. I think we'd all love to be there. But on the other hand, it's not safe. You know, it's definitely not safe. And if somebody got sick, we would never forgive ourselves. And it might be more than one person. It might be lots of people. You know, I was reading a couple months ago, there was a convent in this area where, like, all the sisters got COVID because somebody brought it in. So it would be a big mistake to do that. We're doing the right thing. And actually, you know, the quality of the practice is really excellent. You know, in Dokusan, people are coming in and they're giving these wonderful responses to their koans. It's really thrilling. It's like maybe we should just do dope, online sashin from now on because it's working out. That's a joke, but nevertheless, I think we will always have an online component, so somehow we can figure out how to always have a computer going and a camera and microphone, even for people who can't be at the sesshin or in our weekly schedule because they're in Taiwan or somewhere else. So, this has worked out really well, and I want to thank everybody for, really practicing diligently. It's really wonderful to practice with people who want to practice in this way. I think it. I think one of the. I think it's wonderful that people awaken to this. People awaken to this. So many things are working against people awakening to this, right? There's so many things that sort of gravitate against this. First of all, our culture is very distracting, and that's a big problem, and it's also frightening. For all kinds of reasons, it's frightening. It was frightening long before the current president, right? And it's distracting in a way. People take advantage of the frightening character of our society to distract, to sell us distractions. So, it's difficult for people to ask, you might say, fundamental questions, who are we? Where do we come from, and where are we going? Right? Like the most basic question. But it may be the case that we die and go to heaven. I am skeptical. It may be the case that we go through multiple lives. But no matter what happens, it's definitely the case that as Kurt or as Bob or as Melanie, we get one life. And it's as I'm getting older, it's increasingly the case that I meet people who are consumed by regret. And they are people who, for whatever reason, didn't live the life not only they hoped they would live, because very few of us live the life we imagined that we would live, but they didn't live a life, an unexpected life that was that they find meaningful or exciting, So it's one thing to like when I was 16 years old. I imagined I was going to be a novelist. I wanted to be a great novelist. And I took a creative writing course, and the teachers, basically said, so you're an anthropology major? Maybe you should stick with anthropology, But he was wrong, So I actually, when I got out of college, I wrote a novel. And years later, I looked at it and it's like, oh man, is this ever terrible? Right, it was. You can see. Oh, this is the part that's supposed to be Thomas Pynchon. This is the part that I was imitating all these writers I liked, and I hadn't really lived life, so it was a dreadful failure. And I stopped wanting to be a novelist, and I actually got it involved eventually in Zen, and I found something that I really love. But I meet people. I'm in my 60s now. I'm on this. On the 70s side of 60. So I meet people all the time who didn't write the novel, but then what happened after that wasn't really so special. Wasn't really, they look back and it's just sort of like, well, that was kind of missed, some missed opportunities, sort of is the theme. And I think that's I too have missed many opportunities, and I have thoughts about missed opportunities too. But I'm so glad I found something in my life that made me feel alive. That makes me feel alive, right? And it's so wonderful to have that feeling. I have a friend of mine, Larry Sullivan. I've talked about him before because we were college buddies, Larry was a city kid, and I had already learned about hiking. When I discovered like backpacking in the wilderness, it was like totally wonderful. I had never done anything like that. And, you know, it wasn't part of my family history, that's for sure. And I loved it. I felt totally, and I got Larry involved. And Larry has lived his life as kind of like an outdoorsman. I mean, he's an attorney in Eastern Oregon. He's a city attorney for about three small towns, you could say, in Eastern Oregon. But, you know, he has spent his life backpacking, just like everywhere. And, you know, whenever he's been able to get away and get up into the mountains, he's been up in the mountains or out in the desert. And he was telling me on one of our hiking trips that he ran into this this very famous, that he had a chance to work with this very famous legal powerhouse out west. I can't remember the guy's name, but he's well known. He's like one of these flamboyant millionaire lawyers who has a giant office and all these attorneys working for him. And he liked my friend. They were involved in some kind of case, and he liked my friend Larry's brain power. Larry has first class brains and his courage. You know, Larry can really litigate. He's a good litigator. And he said, "Why don't you come to work with me?" And Larry said he thought about it for like a week, and he decided there's no way because I can't do this, right? I can't, you know, Larry just said, Larry has a lot of personal freedom now. He's been practicing law for 40 some years, and he has this, he has a partnership with a bunch of other lawyers, and he can just say to his colleagues, "Look, I want to go hiking this week. You take over the cases," you know, and he goes. And if he had worked for this big guy, he would have been putting in 80 hours a week, and he would have been making lots of dough. But he couldn't have lived the life he's lived. And a few years ago, I went out with Larry, and he had some other friends who were, we all went on like a group backpack together. And Larry was, he was marvelous to see. You know, he knows the Tetons like the you know, proverbial back of his hand, right? And he can tell you, "Oh, that up there's a little creek up there, and sometimes elk drink up there," and they'll say, "Over here is, you know, this and that," and he said, "Sometimes you can even see wolves," you know, and he has lived a life that is truly alive, right? Truly alive, and I think that's wonderful. You know, to do that, he's made sacrifices, right? So, you know, actually, he's a pretty successful attorney in Eastern Oregon. But, you know, he could have been one of the legal big shots in the West, right? He could have been in best lawyers every year. And he decided not to do that. He decided to be true to this thing, you would say, in himself, that made him feel alive. And I don't think he has any regrets. I think he's lived an amazing life, you know. Not all of us would want to live that life. You know, for him, it's that life. It's, you know, it's getting up into the high country as the sun comes up. You know, we walked up a mountain once and we got to the top of this giant mountain in Montana. And we looked out and he said, this is it for me. This is it, right? Now, you know, it might not be mountain climbing for you. For me, it's Zen, you know. I have made a lot of sacrifices too, you know. I spent a lot of time on the cushion, and I could be at the beach, or I could be in Cancun, or someplace like that, you know. But, you know, this is really where I want to be. It's really what I want to do. And I do it because, you know, on day five of Sesshin, I just feel like I'm pulsing with life. I feel so alive, right? And I think it's wonderful to live that way. You know, inside of us, there is, we say in Zen, your true nature. And, you know, I think if you're true to your true nature, to this precious true nature in yourself, you know, you will have a wonderful life, and you will be, when you reach the end, you have no regrets, you know, really no regrets. You know, I think I wanted to be a novelist because I wanted to be admired like the writers I admired. So, you know, I remember reading Ernest Hemingway when I was in high school and just thinking, oh my gosh, this is it. And then I remember reading in college a writer named Thomas Pynchon. And, you know, I wanted to be Thomas Pynchon, you know, because I wanted to be brilliant, creative like Thomas Pynchon. I wanted to be, I mean, his book was like a bestseller. There were a stack of his books at the bookstore, and they were flying off the shelves, and everybody was talking about it. I don't think I consciously said, yeah, I want to be like that, but everybody wants to be loved and admired, right? So, you know, and I love good writing. I love poetry. I love wonderful novels. So it made sense that I wanted to do that, you know. But, you know, I'm so happy that I haven't done that. I don't think writing gave me the joy or the pleasure or the sense of freedom that Zazen gives me, you know. And I actually like to write. I do a lot of writing, and it's very satisfying. And I've given a certain amount of my time to writing. But, you know, when I am sitting on the cushion, there's a kind of, it's just like something inside me comes to life. And I don't think you have to choose. You know, you can write and you can do Zazen. There have been many great Zen teachers who were actually superb poets. You know, really, Zen has produced a huge number of great poets. And that was true in India, too. There were some amazing monk poets and nun poets in India. So, you know, you don't have to choose. But the thing is, there's so much pressure on us not to find and protect and develop that part of ourselves. You know, there's just so much pressure on us socially. And when things get bad, you know, when things get bad, we tend to sort of want to blend into the scenery, right? You know, it's like if everything's going well, we might be willing to, say, take a risk, right? Take a risk. But when things are like now, they're really crazy and uncertain, and, you know, we tend to become more conservative. People tend to become more conservative. So it's like you know, you think, well, this makes me happy. This makes me feel liberated. But I don't know if I can afford to do that right now. That's one way we're held back. And another way that's, I think, even more powerful is people don't trust themselves enough to listen to that. You know, People don't trust themselves enough to listen to their true nature. You know, every morning, you know, I'm sorry, I don't always do such a good job with this, with the sutras. We have to figure out a better system for the sutras. But you know, reciting the sutras is wonderful. You know, if you, you know, the Kanon Gyo, the sutra we recite, the big long sutra to the Bodhisattva of compassion, please read the 25th the 25th chapter of the Lotus Sutra if you get a chance. But, you know, just trying to do that, if you do that, you just try to do that. It's a kind of meditation practice. And as you go along, if you keep practicing this, you know, it can generate a kind of amazing energy, amazing energy. Let me just add a little bit more about this. You know, at some temples, by the time they have a different sutra, they don't recite this particular one, but in some temples, they're reciting a sutra passage to the Bodhisattva of compassion, Kanon, or Guan Yin. And at the end, there's a rhythm that goes Kanon, da, 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 Kanon, da, da. And at the end, people are just like screaming at the top of their lungs. And at the end, they call Mu, right? It's like, and it gets faster and faster and louder, and then Mu. It's not my style. I don't. But nevertheless, you know, if you practice reciting the sutras, it's far from an empty exercise in Chinese culture, people realize that one way to make people similar is to teach them the same thing, and they all believe the same thing. But in Chinese culture, they realize that actually, if you want to create harmony, people should do something together. So actually, from ancient times in China, reciting things together, like rituals you do together, creates this very powerful sense of connectedness. And it doesn't matter that the sutra doesn't mean anything. It's the practice of reciting, taking the words into your body. You know, you're taking that rhythm into your body and you're doing it with others. It's a wonderful experience. That was sort of a detour. I want to get to what I was really talking about. Every morning we recite these words, Atta Dipa Viharata Atta Sarana Anana Sarana Atta Dipa. You are the light. You are the light. There is no other light. There is no other light. You are the light. So, you know, to practice the Buddhist way is to live with that principle. That, by the way, the Heart Sutra, the Buddha did not say that. I'm sorry, he didn't say that. The Lotus Sutra, the Buddha did not say that. When the Heart Sutra was written, it was about 100 in the Common Era. Buddha had lived 600 years earlier. So I believe that the Heart Sutra is a sacred text, but it's not from the words of the Buddha. It's from great meditation masters 600 years after the Buddha wrote that down. But the Atta Dipa is probably, those are probably the words of the Buddha. It's very likely the Buddha said these words. And he, Atta Dipa Viharata Atta Sarana. You are the light. It's like the light is your house. There is no other house, you could say. Okay. So to be following the Buddhist way is to take that seriously. You know, is to practice. You at first nobody believes that, right? Nobody. Come on. That's nice. But so you practice as though you believed it, as though you believed it. But eventually, you know, you discover in yourself that light, right? And actualizing that light is the most important, the final and most important part of practice. Finding it, not believing it in practicing is part one. Finding it in practicing is part two. And then part three is manifesting, is practicing and manifesting. And I think that, you know, we all get down in the dumps, and the cultural milieu, the cultural atmosphere is so deeply degrading and degraded. And, you know, it's hard to listen to Trump's, you know, with all due respect, you know, his parade of falsehoods, right? And not feel the humans are a failure as a species, right? It's like things are so bad sometimes. And you know, this is just one part of the problems, right? It's like behind all of this, there's another set of problems, the environmental problems. Nevertheless, you know, what we discover in Zen practice is the truth of Atta Dipa, you are the light, you know. And nobody believes it at first, and it takes a lot of work to discover it, right? Because we don't believe it. A few days ago I said, you know, when we feel insecure, we wrap ourselves more tightly in our chains, right? It's like we cling to our illusions, even though they make us unhappy because they provide us with security. So we have to practice. We have to do zazen. We have to do long sitting. You know, long sitting. Sometimes your legs hurt. Sometimes, you know, you think, what the hell am I doing here anyway? But then, you know, I can tell you so many stories where people come into Dokusan on day two and they say, this is awful. I can't stand it. You know, it's all I can do not to, you know, leave. And by the way, at the Rochester Zen Center, they actually make you give up your car keys. They do. If you want to go and practice there, everybody turns in their car keys, and it's like you're not leaving till the end of Sesshin, right? You know, we don't collect, you know, we haven't historically collected car keys, right? But, and people leave, you know, it's like I can pretty much predict, you know, the evening of day two, you know, I'll hear a car, the screech of tires on the gravel as they're heading out, right? But if you don't do that, you know, if you don't do that, you know, it's usually the case, not always, but often the case that around day three, I don't know how many people have come in to tell me, oh my gosh, it's a different world today, right? And what they're, you know, maybe they think the issue is pain in their legs or being tired, but it's really breaking through that crust of illusions, right? That crust of illusions, you know, we cling to our chains, right? You know, that's definitely the case. So, you know, practicing Zen at first is practicing as though this were true. And man, you know, I've been doing this for a fairly long time. I've been practicing Zen for 40 years, and I've been a Zen teacher for about 30 years. And people just, man, they fight tooth and nail, right? They just, it's like, I am not going to love myself, you know, God damn it, if it's the last thing I ever do. But, you know, sooner or later, people realize, you know, what do you know? What do you know? You know, I am the light. I am the light. And when that happens, it's a wonderful moment, I have to tell you. So, you know, we say it, and saying it every morning is really important. Taking the words into your body, you know, and just saying, Atta Dipa, you are the light. You are the light. There is no other light. Right? Just saying, even if you don't believe it. And then, you know, we're practicing as though we had Buddha nature, right? And, you know, 9 out of 10 people don't believe they have Buddha nature. But, you know, at some point, they can't not let it out. They can't not be come face to face with their true nature. And so, you know, at this sesshin, That has happened to many people to some degree. And it will continue to happen because we have practice this afternoon. You know, in Zen, we talk about Kensho. And you'll hear people, when they talk about Buddhism, talk about enlightenment. So the idea is that you're in abject ignorance, and then you have this experience, and suddenly you're like the Buddha. But it's really not like that. That's a false view, okay? I mean, what really happens is that, you know, when you come to Sesshin and you work on your meditation practice, you work on your koan, you know, people are very closed up, and then you probably can't see this with the camera, but there's like a little tiny opening. And, you know, suddenly there's an opening, and people get a glimpse of their Buddha nature. And then they close it up again, or they don't do it voluntarily. It's just habits reassert themselves, right? So there's a little opening, and then it closes up. Habits reassert themselves. And, you know, you can have the most, you know, this happens to everybody. You know, you can have this sit where it's like the skies have opened up. There's no boundaries to be seen, you know, in all directions. It's blue sky. Ao zhou, lan tian. And then, you know, you get up the next day and you think, and the next day it's like, what happened to no boundaries? There's boundaries everywhere again, you know. That happened to me a number of times. One time I got so angry, I almost quit Zen. I was working on a koan, I had this wonderful experience. I got up the next day and I was like back in, you know, I thought, this Zen is a scam, you know, this is a lie, you know. But I understood it better later. You know, it's like little by little you open up and then you close up again. You know, so you have that blissful experience and then it closes up again. And then you have another wonderful opening, and then it closes up again. But it's not always back to square one. It's like the first time it's a tiny little opening, and the second time it's a bigger opening, and then it closes up again, and then it's a bigger opening, and then it closes up again, and so on, right? So it's this process of opening and closing, getting a glimpse of our Buddha nature in the process of working through our obstacles, right? And, you know, the bigger the obstacles, actually, the bigger the opening. I said a few days ago, every barrier can become a gate. Every barrier can become a door. It's like, actually, the doors that are really shut, those are the ones that produce the big openings sometimes. So if you're spending a year on your koan, don't despair. You know, behind that door, there's something really special. You know, the worst, at any rate, this is the process. And even though people don't at first believe they are the light, little by little, they encounter it to some degree more and more as they're going on. And then, you know, the last part of practice is basically manifesting. And what does manifesting mean? Manifesting doesn't mean you wear beautiful robes, or when you walk into a room, everybody goes, wise one, you know. Manifesting means you enter the village with bliss-bestowing hands. You know, basically, maybe you've noticed this. If you're going to do something difficult or something new, if you focus on yourself, it creates many problems. So if you're about to do something new or difficult, maybe you're just trying to decide whether you should take a new job or something, and you focus on yourself, it becomes very difficult to make that decision, right? Because what you're thinking is, look, if I give up the job I have now, what if this new job doesn't work out? I don't like my boss or my coworkers, but it could even be worse where I'm going, and so on. See. But actually, if you think about it in a different way, everything changes. If you say, how can I help? See, how can I help? how can I help? What would help people most? You know, like, that's helped me. So, you know, when I got to the place I work, universities, when you're in your first 5 years, you have to produce all this publication or they'll fire you at the end of 5 years. So you have to have a book and you have to have articles, and if you're not productive, you're out. And, you know, people can go crazy trying to publish all this stuff, and you can become obsessive and unhappy, as so many people do. But, you know, another way to handle the situation is to say, how can I help? You know, if I'm going to write something, how would this be useful to people? How would it help people? Or if I'm teaching a class, right, I can go in the class and say, oh, I've got to get great student evaluations or I won't get tenure, right? Another way to do it is to say, there are 25 people in this classroom. How can I help them? You know, how can I help them? And if you make helping others the focus instead of the risks to yourself or the challenges to yourself, everything changes. It's like all doors will be open to you if your goal is to help others. And, you know, even when it feels like you've got nothing to give, you've got so much to give. It's like I went out on the job market, my first year on the job market as a new PhD, I went out and I didn't get any job. And the second year I didn't get any job. And I finally, in my third year, I got this job at Rutgers. But in my first 2 years, I put in all this time to get this degree and I couldn't even get a damn job. And I was talking to my teacher, Rev Roshi, and I said, you know, I feel so betrayed and I feel so used by this graduate program. I mean, what a bunch of bastards, you know? And he said, Kurt, you know, it's like you always have something to give to others. And it was like, oh, of course. You know, I've been focused on the wrong thing. You know, I was saying, oh, what will become of me? Which is a fair question. But suddenly I said, how can I be of help to others? And it was like from night to day, right? It's like, oh, now I can live, right? Helping others is like the way, you know? So if you ask that question, how can I help others? You'll notice all your fear, all your anxiety goes away. And the focus is now completely different. And you always have something you can give to somebody. You always have something. So, you know, that's a discovery, right? I mean, that's another way of encountering our Buddha nature. You know, just when we think we've got nothing, just when we think we're worth nothing, you know, we suddenly realize, as soon as you say, how can I help? You're suddenly like transformed. You have Kanon's, Kuan Yin's 1,000 arms to help others, right? Maybe you've seen those statues of the Bodhisattva of compassion, and they look a little bizarre, but it's the Bodhisattva of compassion, and she has like 1,000 arms. They usually make a circle, and if you look at what she has in her hands, she has 1,000 hands, and all the hands have. It's a little crazy, but one has a pencil, right? Like a pencil, or a brush, or a trowel, or a mouse. Not really an electric mouse, but, you know, like a mouse, right? Or a book, or like a scalpel, or, you know, it's like the 1,000 hands of Guanyin, of Kanon, of Avalokiteshvara, right? Helping others is the way, you know. You all came here because you either believe that you are the light, or you want to believe that you are the light, or you're on the way to believing that you are the light, and you are the light. And we are liberating that light in ourselves at this session and at past sessions and in future sessions. and you have all been really faithful companions, faithful servants, and faithful helpers of the light. So thank you, and please keep up the good work. Please keep up that good work. With untaught wisdom, he engages in the subtle action of inaction. Wu Xing. With unsolicited compassion, he becomes your true friend. With a single word, he kills you and saves you. See, Webb killed me and saved me. I was feeling sorry for myself. And he said, Kurt, you have countless opportunities to be generous. In one move, he lets you go, and in another, he holds you fast. Tell me, who is it that comes this way? See the following. Ulmon said to the assembled monks, between heaven and earth within the universe, there is one treasure. It is hidden in the mountain form. You take the lantern, entering the Buddha hall, and place it above the temple gate. Secho's verse, look on the ancient bank. Who is that holding the fishing rod? Quietly moving clouds, boundless waters, the bright moon, the white flowers of the reeds. You see by yourself, or you see for yourself. Please see for yourself.